On today's episode of the DFA podcast, we talk about the ALCS and NLCS, and that means Justin Verlander talk, and yes, there's a Pedro Baez reference. Everything's here on the DFA podcast.
Welcome to episode 34 of the DFA podcast. We are back. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, how's it going? Welcome back.
It is going well, and we've been out of action for so long that Baseball Prospectus now has a redesigned website, which is something that I never thought I would say.
I mean,
so it has been a while.
Yeah, it's been a very, very long time. It's only 21 years that we've been waiting for a redesigned BP website, and it's only been, what, almost 20 days since we've last spoken about baseball. So it's a long time for both things. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, but there's been nothing happening in baseball. You know, this is a quiet time of the year. Definitely no arguments over legislative red tape or anything like that, right?
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. I mean, as far as a nominally transaction analysis podcast goes, it is kind of a quiet time for us. But then on the other hand, it's a big time for actually, you know, real baseball and the guys on the field and the playoffs. We totally just bypassed the wild card and the division series round, and we're jumping right into the American and the National League Championship Series. And I know you've been doing a lot to cover them for CBS Sports. I know you've also been writing your usual brilliant features and that kind of thing. But let's talk a little bit about maybe the games. I don't know. It feels weird to say that.
Yeah, and yeah, we can kind of spin this towards a transaction slant. I think, if we begin with the American League Championship Series, the Astros are up 2-0, and it seems like they're well on their way to advancing to the World Series, which is undoubtedly going to make Sports Illustrated pretty happy about that. would look like reckless decision to call them the 2017 World Series champions a few years back, but one of the interesting subplots there, I think, is, you know, we're just a few days now removed from Justin Verlander going out there and shoving like only Justin Verlander can seem to shove in the postseason. And on the other side, you have Sonny Gray, who will not make a start until game four, which potentially could be the final game of the Yankees season. So thinking back to the trades that landed the Astros Verlander and the Yankees Gray, are you at all surprised that this is what it's come to for both of those pitchers?
Well, a little bit. I'm a little bit surprised. You know, it's one of those things where there's some narratives around each player that kind of hinted at this kind of outcome, I feel like, because Justin Verlander does have this reputation as a guy who is able to reach back and give you something a little bit more, whether it's late in the game or in the postseason. He's got that kind of ace reputation, if not necessarily the stats to back it up at times over the last couple of years. So Verlander coming in and throwing 9 innings and striking out 13 in the first game of the ALCS, it's cool, and it's not entirely out of character for the guy. It is surprising. I don't think there's any way you would be... I mean, at this point, it's surprising when any pitcher throws a complete game in a playoff game. So that's kind of wild on its own, but especially the process-heavy Astros. As far as Gray goes, there have always been some questions about his health and therefore always a few questions about his ineffectiveness. And, you know, he had kind of an up and down last couple of years between the injuries and between his performance. So the fact that he hasn't been completely lights out for the Yankees isn't completely shocking, but it is a little surprising that he seems to be fourth on the depth chart behind Severino, Sabathia, and Tanaka.
Yeah, and I thought that Tom Verducci probably had the best article about the Verlander start, and he got into some of the nitty-gritty details about how Verlander has really gotten into analytics and how he's using the Houston Astros high-speed cameras to get a better feel on his grip for a slider and all this neat inside baseball stuff that seemingly only Tom Verducci can produce. And it's kind of funny because Verlander is almost like the last gunslinger in the West at this point in terms of a starting pitcher who can just kind of demand that he goes out there and gets a chance to complete the game. And then you look at his numbers with the Astros, and in five regular season starts, he had a 1.06 ERA, averaged roughly 7 innings per start, struck out 8.6 batters per walk, and all these fantastic numbers. Frankly, he pitched about as well as he could possibly have pitched for them over five regular season starts. And since the postseason has began, he's made three appearances and he's just kept rolling. I know he wasn't great in the division series, but you're right. That was a fantastic game. It was kind of unexpected. It was a bit of a throwback because it does seem like, managers are going to the bullpen at the first sign of trouble this postseason. And I don't know if that makes for a better product, but it's certainly the way that things are headed. And with Gray, as you mentioned, hasn't been the smooth transition to New York that Yankees fans and, the Yankees management was probably hoping for. But the funny thing is, his numbers aren't that far off from his normal numbers. If you look at, his strikeout to walk ratio is 2.19. Well, his career numbers with the A's had him at 2.70, and 3.72 ERA with the Yankees and 3.42 ERA with the A's. If you look at ERA plus, that's 122 versus 115. So, that's not too far off. And he's probably one of those pitchers where the reputation exceeded the statistics. So I guess that's kind of something you have to live with if you're the Yankees. But I do want to open it up a little bit more and talk about the bullpenning strategy that you kind of hinted on with the Verlander reference. Are you in favor of this? Does this make for a more entertaining product for you, or is this just something that, a fad that you hope goes away fairly soon?
So, in terms of the aesthetics of the game, I would much prefer to see fewer pitching changes and long outings from starting pitchers. That's what seems to be more fun. It's more interesting to me. If every pitcher throws roughly the same amount of innings, that becomes kind of boring to me. So, seeing every starter come in for 6 innings and then guys coming in left and right to face different platoon guys and maybe throwing 15 pitches and then switching out a game, it's not really something that does anything for me from an aesthetic standpoint because I'm one of those guys who likes to watch long pitching performances when there's excellence. It's less interesting to me when you have five guys combining for 15 strikeouts in a 9-inning game than it is one guy. And at the same time, I'm also more of a fan of contact and balls in play. And it seems like the more relievers that are used, the less likely we are to get balls in play because relievers tend to strike out more guys than starting pitchers. So from an aesthetic standpoint, I am all for long outings, less strikeouts, less walks. That having been said, from an analyst perspective, I see very much why teams are doing this, and I can completely understand the move in this direction from the team perspective, because I do think it is a more effective way to get outs than running with the starting pitcher as long as possible. I think going with all bullpen games or, 4-inning outings or something out of your starting pitcher is probably going to give you the best chance to win. And if you're the Astros, who cares about the aesthetics of what Joe Baseball likes? I mean, that doesn't really matter very much to them in game two of the ALCS or whatever they wind up doing. Now, the Astros are a bad example because their starting pitchers have actually been good. But, the Yankees going with their bullpen in for long innings in favor of those guys instead of a starting pitcher like CC Sabathia, I definitely see why teams would rather do that. I just don't find it quite as fun to watch.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, we've talked about this before. I'm a little bit more old-fashioned with this stuff. I prefer a rotation-heavy approach versus the bullpen-heavy approach. So you probably won't be surprised to learn that my favorite games recently have been the Astros games with Dallas Keuchel and Verlander both working deep. And yeah, I get the science behind it and I get the idea behind it, but I do have questions about how effective that approach will be. Because you're asking relievers to throw multiple innings to an extent that most of them are not used to. And I think about the Cubs and the Yankees bullpens and how they're kind of gassed at this point because of that. And I also think that you kind of ignore that if you're asking five or six different pitchers to get involved during a game, the odds of one of them being off are far higher than if you're just asking, two or three. And I don't know how to quantify that. I don't know if there is a way to quantify that, but we can't just assume that these guys are going to always be effective. And the more variables you introduce, the more likely one is to go awry. So I think that's an under-talked about issue. I don't know how to, put a number on that though. It's just something that I've been thinking about during this postseason. That said, is there anything else about the ALCS you wanted to touch upon?
I mean, it's the one thing I'll jump on. I do tend to agree with you, by the way, what you just said about the increased number of variables. I think that's a really interesting thing to talk about and maybe discuss more at another time. But as far as the rest of the ALCS goes, I don't know. It's so much fun for people on the East Coast to watch the Astros. Anytime we get more Jose Altuve or Carlos Correa, that's like a super great thing. One thing I kind of want to talk about is the MVP race and Altuve. Just real briefly, and the question of whether or not the MVP award should include anything in the postseason. Because I kind of go back and forth on that as a, should the postseason be part of the MVP narrative? Should we do the voting long after the postseason is over so that we get the postseason influence? Because I definitely feel like with the MVP race this year, if the MVP voting happened after the postseason, there's no question that Jose Altuve would win, right? I mean, he may already be the front runner for the award, but I feel like if you were to take into account the playoffs and his three-homer game and his excellence, that there'd be no question that he would win the MVP award. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing that we're not considering it.
Yeah, well, for the most part, I don't care about the awards, as you know, but I do agree that Altuve, if you were to factor in the postseason, would be the runaway winner because Aaron Judge has been horrendous during the
Yeah, that's
postseason.
true.
What is he up to? I think it's like 19 strikeouts and 30 something at bats at this point. He's homered once, drove in like a handful of runs. It's been just really bad and ugly to watch, frankly. Whereas Altuve, he's hitting what, 500? He's way up there statistically, and he's had some memorable moments. I mean, he had that multi-home run game against the Red Sox, and in the ALCS, hasn't hit a home run or even connected for an extra base hit, but it seems like he's on base constantly. And he had the big run during play to end game two, which a lot of people will remember for just the sheer excitement of it. And some people, if you are known by your initials, will probably just call it a stupid play and leave it at that. But the point is, I agree that Altuve, he'd be the MVP. And I don't know if it's a good thing that postseason performance would cause that kind of swing, because realistically, we're talking about fewer than 30 plate appearances for Altuve and about 30 plate appearances for Judge. That's not even, what is it, like a, that's literally like a week of playing time. So should it really swing things that much that they have a good week? I don't know. I do get the idea that it's an elevated platform, that these games have significantly more meaning than a random series in June in Kansas City. But I'm probably okay as someone who doesn't really care about the awards with just leaving it to regular season performance. We have postseason awards for a reason. They're not as prestigious, perhaps, as the regular season MVP, but I'm okay with the separation there, and I'm okay with Altuve probably winning not only the regular season MVP, but also the ALCS MVP if it comes to that. Him or Verlander would,
Yeah, I
I
was
would
going to
guess, be
say,
the pick at this point.
I think Verlander might have a lead on the ALCS MVP right now because that performance was just so stellar. I do think it's kind of interesting, just real quickly, talking about how great Altuve's been this postseason. Six games, 27 plate appearances. His triple slash line is 565, 630, 957, which is
Is
unbelievable.
that it?
Yeah. But it's funny because in 2015, he did the exact same number of games, exact same number of plate appearances, and his triple slash line was 154, 185, 154. So again, when you talk about this one good week level of performance, basically, you can look back and see this could have gone a very, very different way. in that short form. You can literally be the best hitter in the world or the worst hitter in the world in 6 games. So yeah, maybe we don't want to give too much credence to it for a seasonal award, but I just think it's interesting to think about because I do think like a lot of the awards are very up in the air right now. It's not like there's one clear-cut winner, and it's interesting that this would create a clear-cut winner in one of the awards. So just something worth thinking about.
And I thought it was kind of a funny and maybe even appropriate sequence at the end of that game too, where Judge took some time to get the ball in, and ultimately it wasn't all on him that the Yankees failed to record the out at home plate, but he certainly played a role in it. And of course, Altuve being the one who scored and was the hero of the game and whatnot, that was kind of a funny little touching, not touching, appropriate moment to end that game. I guess touching if you're a Houston Astros fan or just a fan of short people in general, because Judge is a monster and Altuve is a different kind of monster. So yeah, that was a fun moment, and I agree that I'm not sure I really want to open that Pandora's box either.
Yeah.
Anything else in the ALCS that you wanted to talk about?
No, I'm not terribly surprised. I kind of picked the Astros to get to the World Series once the playoffs started, and it looks like they're on that path. So, no, I think that's a good place to end it, and we can flip on over to the NLCS where, again, we've got a 2-0 lead for the favorite in that series as well. So that's kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, and I don't know that the series has been quite as exciting as the Astros Yankee series, just because I'm a starting pitching guy, and Rich Hill going 5 innings, Clayton Kershaw going 5 innings. Like, I get the strategical approach behind that, and obviously the Dodgers can trot out some very fun relievers to watch, but it's not as fun as if Kershaw were going 7 or 8 and just absolutely shoving it out there. So that means we get to talk about things like Charlie Culberson, who, I mean, this is the truest sign that it's hard to predict baseball when Charlie Culberson, who had 15 plate appearances during the regular season and 15 games played, is not only starting in the NLCS for arguably the best team in baseball, but he has actually been very productive with 2 doubles. And I mean,
And good
gee
defense.
Louise. Right. And he had 2 regular season hits, period. And now he's already matched his hit total in 2 NLCS games.
And so this was a super strange situation. So Corey Seager goes down with a back injury. The Dodgers felt the need to add Culberson to the roster because they needed a shortstop, I assume. But they're in the kind of pseudo regular lineup. They already had 2 guys who can play shortstop regularly, and Chris Taylor and Enrique Hernandez. And they're not guys who embarrass themselves at shortstop. They're perfectly capable shortstops. And instead, the Dodgers and Dave Roberts decided, well, not only are we going to put Culberson on the roster, but we're going to have him start the first 2 games. I found that as kind of an odd twist. When a team's got so many outfielders and they still, well, we'll play our 2 better shortstop, at least offensive options at shortstop, in the outfield still, and we'll bring in this guy to play shortstop and see how things go.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense to me at all. And the thing is about Culberson, it's not like you can even point to his platoon numbers for his career and say, well, maybe they wanted to never bat against righties or what have you, because
He's
you know in
bad.
his career he's bad. Yeah, he's very he has a sub 600. I said against righties, I mean against lefties. I'm sorry. He has a sub 600 OPS against righties for his career. And he has a 623 OPS versus lefties for his career. So it's not like he has a platoon split that makes him attractive in a platoon situation or whatnot. And of course, both Taylor and Hernandez bat righty anyway. So that was really not a consideration. But I do find it interesting, and I don't know what to make of it. This might be a case where Roberts played a hunch, and I question that hunch, because if you're having hunches about Charlie Culberson having a big NLCS, then really you're not having hunches at all. You're having, the onset of something that's probably going to land you in a bad spot.
Yes.
So, I mean, what's next? Is he gonna, bring in John Lackey to pitch the bottom of a ninth of an important game, or, where does the madness end? Ryan.
I don't know. I really don't understand it. And so much about Charlie Culberson seems to defy explanation to me. For example, he's been in the league since 2012. Don't know how that happened.
I've been saying that for years, that something about Charlie Culberson defies expectations to me. Yeah, he's bad. I mean, like, let's not. Okay, let's put it this way. He has about 200 major league games under his belt, nearly 500 plate appearances. His career OPS plus is 57. He
Right.
played, just keep in mind, 337 of his plate appearances came in Colorado, and, well, with Colorado, excuse me, and he had a 600 OPS there. If you can't hit in Coors Field, where can you hit? And the answer is apparently in the National League Championship Series.
Right. And yeah, it's mystifying. It seems very out of character for such a analytically driven team like the Dodgers, and especially an Andrew Friedman and Farhan Zahidi guys who have run teams in the past where shortstop defense has been like kind of a meh, okay, well, if we have a decent defender at shortstop, then great. But most of the time, we just care about guys who can hit the ball. I mean, that's been the case a lot of the time in Oakland during Zaidi's tenure under Billy Bean. It's been a lot of the case in the time when Friedman was running the Rays. So it just seems very, very weird to me that they would do something that would probably qualify as not very analytical. And Seager was supposed to be like the big shift in probability for this series, and it really hasn't made any difference up to this point, which is another one of those dumb luck things, I think. You can't predict what happens in baseball. It's great for Charlie Culberson. I mean, like, we were slagging on him a little bit because he's not good. He's got a 207 career true average, but it is really fun for him to have such success at such a high level at the right time. It's the type of thing that'll wind up getting him, three more years in the league instead of falling out of it, and you can't root against that. But
No, and I've long said he reminds me of Daniel Descalso. I mean, I've been making that comparison since Descalso's great postseason. So, it was just written in the stars. Everyone knew it was going to happen someday.
yeah.
But no, I think the more interesting aspect about the Dodgers has been their bullpen and how effective some of these pitchers have been. They signed Brandon Morrow, and we all kind of figured, oh, Morrow is going to be hurt. It's not going to make a difference. He was outstanding this season, and
Oh my,
he,
yes.
I mean, the stuff looks so good. And just to run off Morrow's regular season statistics: 43 and two-thirds innings, he gave up 31 hits, 10 runs, 0 home runs, and he struck out roughly 5.56 batters per walk. That is just outstanding. Nowadays, they're using Tony Watson and Tony Cingrani, who were two deadline acquisitions, as their lefties on lefties. Then they. I mean, the rotation depth being what it is, they're able to use Kenta Maeda in a relief role, and he has been fantastic out of the bullpen. Then they turn it over to a cheat code, essentially, in Kenley Jansen. And I think Jansen is my favorite reliever to watch nowadays, mostly because it means the Dodger game is about over and I can go to bed, but also because he's just so dominant. And, last night I was watching, and, Wilson Contreras just had no chance. And then, Almora comes up and he has no chance, and it's just the same thing over and over with that high cutter, and the guys just can't lay off it. And I just try to envision myself in their shoes, and I'm thinking, man, how does that pitch look out of the hand, and with its movement and all, like how much that look for them to continuously swing at that high cutter and just miss it. I mean, not even make contact to foul it off or whatever, just completely miss it over and over again. And it's just hard to visualize because, like, how often do we see that? And the answer is not that often. And that's why he's the best closer in baseball and someone that, has a chance at least to go down as the best closer of his era if he can stay healthy and continue to be this effective.
And, as a former catcher, that's even more amazing to me that you not only are this good, but to convert so late in the game to a pitcher. I mean, it's mystifying. That cutter is just, it's the most devastating pitch in baseball right now, I would argue. I don't know how you could argue against any other pitch in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. You could probably, argue on a weighed basis that someone's fastball is more effective, especially if you're a starting pitcher or whatever. But And just in terms of sheer aesthetics, it's a really wonderful pitch to watch too. This series has some nice aesthetic pitches. I really like good changeups. I really like slow vertical over horizontal breaking curveballs, and
The Rich Hill
I've come
special.
to really like, huh?
I said the Rich Hill special.
Yep. And cutter, a nice cutter is pretty nice to watch as well. So it's a good series for aesthetics. And speaking of aesthetics, let's focus on something that I actually don't like about this series, and that's been the Dodgers' leads against John Lester. This goes back to a national series for me. If you're going to take an aggressive lead, and by aggressive I mean around or past the cutout, the first base cutout, why don't you just run? And last night I was watching Enrique Hernandez, and he was doing all the dancing, he was doing the stop or the start and go, excuse me, the start and stop and all this, and he wouldn't run. And I don't think that gets into Lester's head. I think it actually annoys me more than it annoys John Lester, because I'm like, why don't you just go? Like, none of this actually serves a purpose if you're not willing to run. And yet teams really do seem reluctant to actually run on Lester. And I know he had the pickoff, and I know he had a regular season pickoff too, but does that drive you crazy too, or is it just me?
Well, I think it's ridiculous. It does drive me crazy. I hate the fact that teams were not more aggressive against John Lester over the past couple of years in the playoffs. The Dodgers seem to be especially, like between last year and this year, they seem to be especially weird about it with the dancing around and the fake outs rather than running on it. It just seems, like you said, annoying. And I don't understand what the benefit is because we've got a lot of data now that kind of proves that it doesn't really get in Lester's head. It might be different if you were trying to do this with a young pitcher or somebody who's more inexperienced or easily excitable, but John Lester's about as steady as it goes. He's a guy who's been in the playoffs for, 10 years plus as a starter. I mean, he doesn't seem like this affects him at all, and I don't understand what the benefit of it is for the Dodgers unless they're going to be more aggressive in terms of actually taking the extra base.
Yeah, and I mean, otherwise, it just, like you said, serves no purpose whatsoever. Although I will note that you remember last postseason when Jock Peterson literally got down in a track stance when Lester was
Yes.
pitching? Yeah, that's been the only highlight and the only positive thing to come out of all this. Otherwise, it's just like, run.
Yeah,
You
really.
know, just run. And we talked about the Dodgers bullpen a little bit.
Well,
I think it's only right.
before we move
Oh,
on
I was going
past
to
the
focus on the
Dodgers.
Cubs bullpen now.
Yeah, before we move past the Dodgers bullpen, I'd love to talk about the Cubs bullpen with you in a minute, but the one guy I wanted to talk about the most on this has been a guy you touched on before is Kenta Maeda. Because I can really talk about him from a transaction standpoint, because this conversion to the bullpen seems like it has made him a dramatically more effective pitcher in short bursts. And I think this is absolutely fascinating because with the Dodgers and their kind of tendency to get starter after starter after starter and have guys on guys on guys in case of injuries. The idea of converting Maeda to the bullpen long term seems to be something that would at least be worth considering. And another reason why it may be worth considering is because of the structure of his contract. Maeda, if you remember, signed an 8-year contract for $25 million, and it's entirely to make more than that $25, it's entirely performance based in terms of games started and innings pitched. And a conversion to the bullpen might not only make him a very effective relief pitcher, but it would basically ensure that the Dodgers would never pay him more than $25 million. And that's really interesting to me because there's a lot of incentives, I think, for the Dodgers to convert him into a full-time relief role, if not this year, but maybe like in a year or two. That would really be kind of gross from a, like a wage depression perspective as well. So I'm kind of torn because I like relief Maeda. He looks fantastic. You always get more value out of a guy if he's a starter, even if he's a starter that pitches six innings or whatever. But it makes it a really interesting thought experiment if a little bit in a uncomfortable way because the Dodgers could do this and get themselves a really magnificent setup man for Kenley Jansen at an extremely low price.
Yeah, and now I have to root for Maeda to move back to the rotation, because even if it makes some baseball sense, I don't really like the idea of him, losing millions and millions of dollars because the Dodgers want to be cheap. And this reminds me of last season. Oh, I guess it was 2 seasons ago at this point, wasn't it? Well, let me look it up. But anyway, Brandon Beachy, he had been in the rotation early on in the year, and he wasn't good. To be clear, it was 2015, so he'd made 2 starts. He had 8 innings, and there was nothing significant about that except for the fact that he actually received $500,000. His option increased to $500,000 for every. Oh, okay. So that was 1, 5, 10 starts. Blah blah. That's not the one I'm talking about. So his buyout had $250,000 added to it with 10 innings pitched in 2015, and you'll remember that year, but Dodgers used a ton of different pitchers. I mean, they brought basically everyone in their 40 man up, it seemed like, to make a start at some point. So Beachy had 8 innings and he never appeared again. They didn't bring him up in September. They didn't bring him up during the year. And that just felt like intentionally, suppressing him in a way that cost him $250,000. And I know that's not a big deal to a player who's, making a 40 man salary, but it's also not insignificant. Even and also, Brandon Beachy, I mean, he hasn't been in the majors since. He probably will never pitch in the majors again. And so that $250,000 that didn't seem too significant then, probably a lot more significant now that he's literally thrown in one game, one regular season game at least, in the last 2 seasons, and that was in rookie ball, presumably as, a rehab assignment or whatever. And yeah, this is a team that does not shy away from some of these, let's say, sketchy decision making, and it seems like it's spread. I mean, you had the Bud Norris and the, oh shoot, who was it? Was it Ricky Nolasco
It was Jesse
and
Chavez.
Jesse Chavez? Sorry, Ricky Nolasco, for bringing you into this. But yeah, it seems like it's spreading, and that you're seeing more and more teams place a little bit more emphasis on avoiding paying those incentives. I mean, okay, here's one for you. We were talking about postseason awards earlier. I heard that there was a team that offered a contract to a player last winter, and there was an incentive for the player winning the divisional series MVP. And as you probably know, there is no such thing as the divisional series MVP. So, I don't know if that was an honest mistake or one of those let's float it and see if he gets by things, but this is just, it's an unfortunate part of baseball that does not seem to be going away anytime soon.
I definitely agree with you there, especially about it being unfortunate. I mean, it's just, think about this. Would the Dodgers rather have Kenta Maeda as a $3 million a year relief pitcher or a $13 million a year starting pitcher?
Yeah, and I mean, they can use him in a hybrid role and avoid those incentives and get a little bit of both, right?
Because there's $6.5 million annually tied to games started. So as long as they use him as a swing man and don't give him 15 starts a season, he's ineligible for those bonuses. And then
Yeah, I
the
mean,
rest of
they can
his
do that.
bonuses are just on innings pitched, and that's basically $250,000 for every 10 innings after 90 that he pitches. So you throw him in a Chris Davinsky kind of role where you throw him 90 or 100 innings out of the bullpen as a more used relief pitcher, and you're only going to wind up paying him like $3.5 million for the season.
Yeah, and they'll probably get him stretched out next spring and talk about how, there's a competition for the rotation spot, and then he'll make maybe a start or two per month, and just enough to, avoid the incentives. And this has a very Branch Rickey feel to it all of a sudden. I don't know how much you've read on Branch Rickey, but there are stories out there about how, he owed Preacher Rowe a raise, and he brought two hunting dogs to Rowe's place, and he basically said, like, "Hey, man, I can't afford the raise, but I'll give you these dogs." And like 2 or 3 days later, the dogs had left and returned to Ricky's home because, that's from Boys of Summer or whatever. And then there are other stories about how, Ricky would not sign contracts that he had agreed upon until after he'd seen the player play professionally, or he'd always change parameters on what it would take to get a promotion or a raise or whatever. And Branch Rickey's very celebrated, but there was a lot of stuff that, if you actually know about it and you think about it, is really not the kind of acts that you should that should lead one to be lionized. And
Sure.
yet, I guess it makes more and more sense that he would be with the current landscape in baseball, where saving money is one of the executive talents that these teams look for the most. So.
Excellent point. Excellent point. So, enough about me complaining about Kenta Maeda. I think actually what the Dodgers will do is I think they'll give him another season in the rotation, to kind of see what they've got and see if he can turn into the kind of, real frontline starter that they might have imagined he could be if he could stay healthy. And then after that, they might switch him over to the bullpen. But, so in the interest of going back to what you were interested in before, you want to talk a little bit about the Cubs bullpen, such as it is?
Yes, and how did they get here? I mean, again, last night's game, Brian Dunson was pitching in a high leverage performance, and we haven't seen that one before. But then they bring in John Lackey, and it's just like, wow, how did this Cubs bullpen get here? Because on paper, they should have a lot more talent than that. Not just Wade Davis, but Carl Edwards. He's pretty good. I know he's wild, and he had some home run issues against Bryce Harper, but. Other than that, Pedro Strop has been highly effective for years now. Hector Rondon is not that far removed from being an effective late inning reliever. Justin Grimm has kind of fallen off the map. Koji Uehara is injured, and he was someone they were kind of counting on to give them at least a seventh inning presence, maybe even an eighth inning presence. And beyond that, this bullpen's so thin that bringing in Lackey like they did, I mean, it wasn't better than bringing in Davis, but it would seem better than bringing in anyone else. And it's like, how did they get to the point where, Lackey, the guy who gave up the most home runs in the National League or whatever, is actually a defensible relief option at this stage, not only of the game, but of the season?
Right. I don't know how they got here. It seems like it's not like the Cubs have not tried to address their bullpen, both in the offseason when they acquired Davis, both during the season when they acquired Justin Wilson. But, Justin Wilson didn't make the NLCS roster because he hasn't been great recently. And in terms of developing relief pitching, Carl Edwards Jr. has been an unmitigated success, except for this postseason. He's been bad. But they haven't really done much to develop a decent relief pitcher since Rondon. And Rondon has not been good recently.
That's because they haven't done much to develop any pitcher.
Right.
I
That's
mean,
been a problem with this team. That's why they built the team kind of the way that they did. They focused almost entirely on offensive players. And that's fine. You can do
yeah.
that. And then you can trade your Eloy Jimenezes for Jose Quintana, and you can trade your Jorge Soler for Wade Davis. That's all great. But I think the end result is like we've got a severe bullpen disadvantage here from the Cubs to the Dodgers, which is weird to say because the Dodgers bullpen is always terrible. But they don't have the depth and they don't have the top end talent, especially with Edwards being ineffective recently, to really compete. So I guess then they've got to kind of rely on their starting pitchers to come in relief. And between Lackey and Jake Arrieta, those may not necessarily be the best possible starting pitchers to move into relief roles. Lackey especially. Arrieta might be interesting if he comes in relief because, a couple of an extra mile per hour on his fastball is going to look a little different than some of these other pitchers. But, John Lackey is what he is at 39 years old. He shouldn't really be much of an option for this team, but they don't have any better ones.
Yeah. And that's just amazing to me. But I wanted to touch on the Cubs' inability to develop pitchers. If you think about the last 5 or so years, the best pitchers they've developed are, probably Zach Godley and, oh man, they had a reliever they developed, and now I'm blanking on who it is. But Zach Godley is arguably either the best or the second best pitcher they have drafted and developed in the last 5 plus years. And Godley is fine. The Cubs would probably welcome him back. But that's not a great track record of drafting and developing pitchers that kind of goes, I don't want to say it's ignored, but it's certainly not touched upon as often as it could be if the Cubs weren't as successful as they have been, not only, in the regular season, but obviously winning the World Series last year. And this has been a season where, the rotation really hasn't been as effective as it was in the past. Lester had a 100 ERA plus, Lackey was under 100, Hendricks obviously really good, but This is going to be a situation that the Cubs have to address heading forward, not only their bullpen, but their ability to draft and develop pitchers, because you can't, you're not always going to have a Eloy Jimenez to trade for a Quintana, and you're not always going to be able to go out there and, basically steal Arrieta away from your team.
Yeah, I will say, when you talk about drafting and developing pitchers, you're absolutely right about drafting or signing international free agents. I do think we have to give the Cubs player development team at least a little bit of credit for Arrieta and for Kyle Hendricks, though, because while those guys were not guys that the teams acquired as amateurs, those are guys that do look considerably different now than they did when they were acquired. So I think they should get a little bit of credit for those guys, but again, you're absolutely right in that you can't just count on the fact that your player development staff's going to be able to turn Kyle Hendricks into a Cy Young winner or Jake Arrieta into a Cy Young winner, and they have nothing really coming up in the pipeline, do they? I mean, Dwayne Underwood is not what you would consider, one of those top end guys, I don't think, at this point. And beyond, I mean, they really don't have a lot of. There's Trevor Clifton in the minors, but that's really it. And yeah, they're going to have to figure out some way to get some young blood pitching in there because they don't have an infinite amount of money. You can't buy all the pitchers. You have to at least grow one or two.
Yeah, but the good news for the Cubs is they have done well drafting and developing position players. And, we're seeing this postseason. Albert Amore is kind of making a little bit of a name for himself with some very good defense and some timely hitting. And, that's not what you can necessarily say about a different recent top draft pick for the Cubs, and Ian Happ, who, despite pretty solid regular season performance, has kind of gone missing this postseason.
Yeah, I wish I could understand that. I don't know what's going on there. The Rookie of the Year race is not close this season, like in either league. But Ian Happ's had a really good rookie season for this team. He wound up with a 253, 328, 514 triple slash line, which is good for a 284 true average. So like definitively above average. He had 24 homers, like 44 extra base hits in total, and he's not a great defender, but he's mobile. You can play him in second base, you can play him in the corner outfield, you can move him around, maybe a little center field. So he was like a two-win player this year. That's great. It's fabulous. I don't know why he's playing not at all in the end of the NLDS and the beginning of the NLCS. It seems like it could be another one of those hunches, the not very scientific choices, because John Jay's been getting a lot of run in the outfield, and I'm not entirely sure why he's a better option over Happ, other than that he got a few timely hits in the end of the division series and the beginning of this series. So yeah, I'm kind of confused as to what's going on there. Do you have any ideas?
Nope. And I also say that I think the bigger issue, even than John Jay getting playing time, has been Zobrist getting playing time. And, that pains me to say because Zobrist is obviously, one of my favorites. I was completely wrong about him back in the day. I used to think that Willie Iobar would be a better player, which, boy, did that one age
Whoops.
poorly. Right. That might be the worst call I've made. And I'm the same dude who thought that Andrew Cashner was a better player than Anthony Rizzo. But anyway, moving off from that, Zobrist was really bad during the regular season. He's older than most people realize. It would just seem like, slotting happened instead of Zobrist, that either position, the second base or the outfield, would make a lot of sense and would make this team much better, and yet they haven't done that whatsoever. And I don't know if Madden is at the point where he is valuing experience and valuing the idea of Zobrist and the idea of Lackey more than he's acknowledging their present day flaws or what have you, but it certainly makes you wonder because that is just such an ob seemingly obvious decision to make. Is there something going on with Hap that we don't know about? Is he battling something? Is he a little too jumpy or something? And Madden doesn't think he'll be able to handle the postseason. I really don't know the answer because this is a team that, fundamentally, he got to this point because they've relied so much on young players who were making their introduction into the postseason, and it worked out well for them. It really has worked out well for them, and it's not a good sign when last night, when Rizzo took a ball off the hand from Jansen, that In the CBS Slack, we were kind of talking about what they would do if Rizzo had to come out of the game, and the idea of inserting Hap didn't come up until, three or four different scenarios have been passed about, including, inserting Tommy La Stella or Alex Avila. Like, at some point, that's not a good sign if,
No.
Ian Happ, who was one of your top draft picks in recent years and who really performed well, as you noted, isn't even on the board because, you kind of forget he's on the roster. That's how little they've used him. And yeah, I don't know what's going on there, but I would be interested in the answer.
Yeah, me too. And it's another one of those things where it's like, if you're not going to use a guy like that, then this offseason, they better be shopping him for some quality pitching, I would think. And, when you look at the Cubs long term, I mean, we got so many questions about Zobrist. Ian Happ is a very suitable Zobrist replacement. I refuse to use the words the next is Ben Zobrist because it's been done to death over the last 10 years, and there isn't one. Spoiler alert. Nobody else is quite like Ben Zobrist, but he's a switch hitter. He can play infield and outfield corners. He can hold his own defensively. He's not a plus defender like Zobrist was, and he certainly doesn't have Zobrist's approach, although he might have his power. But yeah, like there's a couple of guys on this Cubs roster in Zobrist and Jason Hayward, and I don't know, maybe Kyle Schwarber, who may not be long for this team in everyday roles, and it's definitely going to be interesting to see going forward, especially if they get bounced in the NLCS, how they want to kind of address this roster if they want to keep sinking. I'm not even worried about the money, but it's more like the plate appearances in these guys, or if they're going to try to be creative and do some other things and mix up the roster a little bit to get, maybe some better performance out of some of these positions.
Yeah, so which one of them is the future Ray? Out of Schwarber, Happ, Addison Russell, whomever else, which one of those do you think will be the future Tampa Bay Ray when they inevitably trade for Archer or whomever,
See,
Odorizzi or whomever?
that's a tough question because Addison Russell has the character concerns that the Rays seem to value greatly. They love to get guys who have off-field issues, but I mean, obviously Schwarber's the guy to go to an American League team, and there's less issue with the outfield than there is with shortstop. I mean, you could move Javier Baez to shortstop, but Russell is a nearly irreplaceable player on this team. So Schwarber going to a team like the Rays makes absolute total sense. I don't think at this point he could headline an Archer package, quite honestly. If they were going to trade for Chris Archer, they'd need to give up Kyle Schwarber and Ian Happ maybe. If not, and a couple of, other pieces as well, I think. So that's the big question there is, unfortunately, if the team really does want to trade Kyle Schwarber, they missed by a year, big time.
Yeah. And it seemed obvious at the time. I know they
It
love
did.
him as a clubhouse presence and whatnot, but he was never going to fit this roster. And, maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation if he had his normal offensive output all season long, but I don't know. I had never questioned that he could hit. It's just a matter of how would he fit into this roster long term. And we've, clearly seen that he really doesn't, because that defense is just going to keep getting worse. They're not going to move Rizzo for him. And, great clubhouse presence or not, at some point you have to do what's best for your lineup, your roster construction. And unfortunately for, Cubs fans who love Schwarber, that probably means trading him this winter. And really, as you mentioned, should have been trading him last winter when his value was probably as high as it was ever going to be. So,
Right, but
plus, the
you don't trade him after you win the World Series, and you don't trade him. I would say you don't trade him this offseason because his value's at a low. So I would think. I mean, maybe it's gone up a little bit since he had his bad start to the season, but I think there would be some hesitation in the Cubs front office to trade him this offseason because if he has a really great start to next season, he could be a lot more valuable at the deadline or after improving his value a little bit, and he's not expensive yet. But at the same time, it's like, they're going to have to do something to adjust a little bit this offseason. And, the guy who makes the most sense to move on from is Ben Zobrist, but who really would give up very much for him at that point with the combination of his contract and the diminishing performance, I think.
Yeah, I would say though that I think if you're going to trade Schwarber, doing it after the World Series makes a ton of sense because you have so much goodwill. That's a good send-off for him and all of those, warm and fuzzies and whatnot. I think if you're going to do it, that would actually have been totally acceptable time to do it, even if fans would have been like, why not give him one season where, he can show us what he can or cannot do on the roster or whatnot. So
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. This is a very interesting team, and I know we're talking about it as if they've already lost the series, even though, there's at least two games remaining, and who knows? The odds are certainly not in the favor of the Astros, excuse me, of the Astros, of the Cubs or the Yankees to come back, but weird things happen all the time, and boy, would it not be just like the Cubs or the Yankees to stage a historic comeback just to annoy most of America. So
Can you tell me how much you would prefer an Astros Dodgers World Series to a Cubs Yankees World Series? Because to me, like, I am so much more excited about the potential Astro Dodgers World Series, even though I'm not always a huge fan of the optics of how the two front offices handle their business. The players on both those teams are the guys I really want to see in the World Series this year, not, the Cubs who are in there every year, or the Yankees who are kind of on the rise, but they're the Yankees, so screw them. So yeah, I'm much more on board with an Astros Dodgers World Series at this point.
yeah, that makes sense. And I kind of dread the think pieces that would come from that series on either end.
Yeah, that's pretty
But
bad.
what I'm rooting for the most, Brian, as you know, is I don't root for any individual team. I just root for whoever will make the game and sooner, whoever will make the series and sooner. So I'm really hoping for, the Astros and the Dodgers to pull off clean sweeps, and then we can have a classic 7-game World Series just like last year. And that'll be a nice way to end the season because, man, we don't want 7-game series between these teams, right? Like, these first two games have shown us that I know it's just two games, but, like, can you really imagine five more games of this Cubs-Dodgers series at this point? We're already having John Lackey pitch in high leverage innings. We're already having Charlie Culberson play the hero to some extent. Do we really need five more games of that?
Nope, not in the NLCS. I will say the ALCS, these 2-1 games make me a little bit, okay, I could go 7 for the Astros Yankees. That would be fine. And, the more Gary Sanchez and Jose Altuve I get to watch, the happier I'm going to be. But yeah, the Cubs Dodgers, we can go ahead and call that one. I will say, though, when we talk about the World Series, if we're going to do an Astros Dodgers World Series, I would like you to inject a Clayton Kershaw, Justin Verlander Game 7 directly into my veins, because that would be awesome.
Yeah, but that's going to lead to Kershaw getting. Oh man, could you even imagine? Like, Verlander is like a genetic freak, and no one's going to appreciate that aspect of it. What they are going to appreciate is that, Clayton Kershaw gets yanked after five innings, so Brandon Morrow and Kenta Maeda and the ever failed starters can. Oh man,
Yeah.
geez Louise. The think pieces are going to be bad no matter what, though. Where you're going to have extreme Moneyball times a zillion, we're going to have whatever think pieces would come from, the quote unquote Silicon Valley team. Do we have to play a World Series?
I do think
Can
we have
we?
to. I think it's part of the rules. The
Couldn't it be like
other thing.
2008 where they just close it down? Like, they never finished that 2008 World Series after the rain delay. We don't know who would have won.
No.
So,
It's just completely up in the air. It's a shame because David Price was doing so well. I have no idea who eventually won that World Series. So,
because they didn't complete it.
right. The one thing from a completely and wholeheartedly selfish perspective is that since I'm writing the comments for the Astros in this year's Baseball Prospectus Annual, if they do happen to get eliminated quickly, awesome for me because I can hold off on some of those major league players I've been trying to not write about because of their inevitable playoff stories that I'm going to have to talk about. It's hard to write the Justin Verlander comment until we know for sure how this postseason finishes up, or Altuve's, or things like that. So, let's speed it
Yeah.
along a little bit, guys.
I remember those days writing those annual comments, hoping that someone like Charlie Culberson, who seemed completely innocent and whose season's narrative seemed like a foregone conclusion a month ago, is now somehow the center of our attention. So I do not envy you for that. Then again, you probably don't envy my situation either, where it seems like oh man, it's been fun, but it's a grind. It is definitely a grind, and I have new appreciation for the players who actually have to go out there and give something physically and not just, check in mentally every single night or
Yep.
every single day.
And
So,
on the other hand, it's baseball, and we get to
yeah.
talk and write about baseball, so it can't be all that bad. So,
And there's no Pedro Baez in sight. So, how
excellent.
bad can it be?
Everybody wins when Pedro Baez isn't sucking up our time. So, on that note, we won't suck up any more of your time. We will call it an episode. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you guys again soon.